Live from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the Total Education Show, the talk shop for teachers, parents, and administrators. Here's your host of the show, Neil Haley, the Total Tutor.
Fantastic. I'm excited to welcome the program from American Ninja Warrior, co-host Akbar Baja, Bia Miller. How are you, man?
And going down tonight, and it's going to be a big show. We're in the finals. We have the Los Angeles finals. We've got some amazing stories tonight. We've got, you're going to see Jesse LeGraff. You're going to see Flip Rodriguez. So you're going to see some big-time competitors go at it. Of course, the ones who move on from here get a shot at $1 million in Las Vegas. But one of our strongest cities here in Los Angeles, I can't wait for everyone to see the story.
You know, it's interesting, Akbar, when you talk about American Ninja Warrior, a lot of people don't understand how challenging this is. I had Evan Dollard on a couple years ago talking about how challenging the task was, and I started watching it. The obstacle course is so difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, it's wicked because it's a physical and mental thing where, you know, you see some of the obstacles and you see the way they look and you go, wow, like I could never do that. And that's the physical element. But the mental part that a lot of people don't know is that when the competitors step on the course, even though they've been doing it for several years, it's the first time they've seen the obstacles. So each year we put in new obstacles. This year we had to do 27 new obstacles because we knew that we had to step it up. Last year, of course, Isaac Caldeiro was our first winner, and he won $1 million. And so now everybody wants a shot at it. I mean, we're talking about people who are quitting their jobs, who are now – there are more ninja gyms than there have ever been in the history. I mean, you can go from coast to coast, and you'll find multiple Ninja Warrior gyms. I mean, in the Midwest, they've got one on the East Coast, on the West Coast, up north. Wherever you go, there's Ninja Gym because everybody's now preparing. This has literally become a sport. I mean, there's become conversations now, should American Ninja Warrior be a sport? And the question to me is, absolutely should be a sport. And you look at the people who are competing. What I love about it is different from any other sport is the fact that you have men and women competing on the same exact platform. There is no adjustment. There is no maneuvering. None of that. We do it the same for men, regardless of your size, height, weight, age. It doesn't matter, gender. And so that's where, you know, this thing becomes really relatable. And I think that's why the stories are so cool. And you think about the stuff that some of these competitors have to overcome. I mean, some of them are just fresh out of chemotherapy. Some of them have gone through personal through personal trauma emotional trauma, where you think, well, how could someone compete at this high level having gone through this? We had several cities ago, we had a competitor, AT3, who competed on with prosthetic, one leg. And, you know, to watch that, or, you know, my father who has Parkinson's disease, and of course, you know, recently we lost Muhammad Ali, obviously the greatest of all time. And, you know, people see Muhammad Ali and they see two things. They see, you know, the sign of greatness, but we also see a man who's fighting the battle against Parkinson's, a man, you know, once known for his quick feet. And, you know, I mean, I still think back to 1996 with him holding up the torch and looking at my father. And I just go, wow, man, Parkinson's so tough. And then all of a sudden I meet Allison Topperwine, Ninja Warrior, who right before she was getting ready to compete had to take some of her Parkinson medication, and she's shaking and she's shuffling, and she goes out there and she's competing on American Ninja Warrior. And I ask people the question, what's your excuse? Why can't you be an American Ninja Warrior? But, I think it speaks to everyone, regardless if you're just, you know, a person that thinks that, oh, I'm just an ordinary person, oh, I couldn't do it, or if you're an extraordinary athlete like an Aaron Rodgers or the retired Charles Woodson, these guys who I spoke with personally who told me, you know, I want to do American Ninja Warrior. Of course, Aaron Rodgers may not have a chance with all that money he's making.
and what about you in the obstacle course? Have you ever tried it?
Yeah, I have tried it. I tried it several years back at Houston, but contractually I'm not supposed to when it's all set up. But I just kind of ignored the idea that the contract said I couldn't. And I said, maybe they'll give me a pass here because I said I didn't read it. But I didn't get too far just because I was shut down by the NBC execs and the production company. And they were like, no, we can't have this. You got to get off. I was like, ah, you know, so I felt like a little kid, like, oh, no, why I? but I will say, though, it's been it was an amazing experience, and it allows me to connect with the athletes. People always ask, man, how is it that you're so excited? Because I can relate to them. I can relate to the, you know, the story of being that athlete and being that person who's the underdog.
And you imagine also how they end up being YouTubes, like just like one person going through the obstacle course. I remember a story a couple of years ago of this woman who just kept going through and doing such amazing things, better than the men.
Casey Catanzaro. Casey Catanzaro. She became, at that point, was the first woman to ever complete a qualifying and a finals run. And we had seen so much success from the men in the previous season. And, you know, the one thing was like, well, this course is really just meant for men. And there was some doubt. There was some doubt, I think, throughout, where it was like, well, is this obstacle too hard, or is it just, you know, was it a psychological thing? And we kind of just stuck to our guns. And we just kind of stuck with it. And when you start looking at it, and all of a sudden, when Casey Catanzaro, 5 feet, 100 pounds, maybe 100 pounds, woman going through there, and, I mean, competing with, I mean, a bunch of Hercules, and went out there and absolutely destroyed the course. And that's when it just started to light motivation. And it's kind of like success begets success. Then all of a sudden, in comes Megan Martin, and she had her success. And then you have Jessie LeGrass, and then you have Jessie the Flex LeBret, and then you have all of these women competitors coming out, Michelle Warnke. And then all of a sudden now, we've had more than five women get up the warp wall and go far and go to Vegas. And so we've seen these competitors just continuously grow. And so now there's a whole wave of women come out there who are better than a lot of the men who are competing. I mean, where else do you see men and women? You don't see it in the NFL. You definitely don't see it in the NBA. No. They have a WNBA and an NBA league. We don't have that. We don't have women American Ninja Warrior and men American Ninja Warrior. We have one American Ninja Warrior. We have website that kind of documents the series, American Ninja Warrior Nation. Check it out. It's pretty good. But this Monday night, I mean, you'll see why the craze is just getting bigger and bigger tonight, 8 p.m. on NBC.
So after 8 p.m. NBC, how much more of the competition's left for the season, Akbar? What's left after?
Well, we're in the finals, so we'll have four after tonight. We'll have four more final rounds before we head into the Las Vegas finals for the championship round, for the chance for $1 million. So we have Los Angeles, we have Philadelphia, we have OKC, and I'm forgetting another city that we have. Oh, and Atlanta, we have those finals coming up, and then after that, we go for the big money.
And every year that they don't win $1 million, right, Akbar? You said that it doesn't happen always.
Last year, that's right. Last year was the first year that anyone had ever won on American Ninja Warrior. And I think that was one of the intriguing points of it. Like, man, like, how is it that no one's ever won the show? Each year, you take any show, you know, somebody's always winning something. Right. We had never had $1 million winner, and it was so cool. Because I remember coming out of San Diego State and getting a contract with the Oakland Raiders. And I remember looking at my first paycheck, you know, coming from humble beginning. And I just remember staring and that feeling of going, oh, my goodness, my life is about to change. And I saw that same thing in Isaac Caldeiro, you know, guy who told me, man, I never had more than $5,000 in my account.
Gosh.
And to see him just that look, it was just like glazed. You just have to have been there to see the look on his face. And I was so genuinely happy for him that he had won $1 million and that his life was going to change.
You seem so pumped up. Best place again tonight. Tune in 8 p.m. Eastern, American Ninja Warrior on NBC. But also, Akbar, where can we follow you and find information on you?
Absolutely. You know, I'm on all platforms except for Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, Instagram. I'm Akbar, AKBAR underscore GBAJA. And then for Facebook, I'm Akbar, GBAJA, all one word.
Well, thanks for calling, man. Best of luck. And I'm going to be playing this over and over. I run a lot of the shows again and again to promote the rest of the season as well. So thanks for telling me the story and how motivated you are about being a co-host on American Ninja Warrior. It's a really exciting show. I hope everyone tunes in. Take care.
Thank you.
See ya. Okay, bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back.
I'm all year and ready to go, and glad they won the cup, so it'll be good to meet him. It'll be nice to
Absolutely, and were you a fan of Nick before he came to Pittsburgh?
Absolutely, yeah, no, definitely. Back from when he was on the Canucks and all the way through the Ducks as well, so it's good. We're glad to have him.
Where are you from in Pittsburgh?
From North Hills.
North Hills, where?
Just right over by the subway and Papa John's.
Oh, Babcock. Oh, fantastic. So being in the back row, I think you'll be in good luck. I think it's 200 in the Just wanted to make sure, hey, we'll get you on and stuff like that, and say, what would be a message to all the other Pittsburgh fans out there to get the opportunity? What did they miss out on?
You're missing out on Bonino.
Exactly. The HPKA line.
That's absolutely.
Awesome. Okay.
Hello.
Hey, guys. We're doing a radio interview and a television. Neil Haley, BPTV, and nationally, Total Celebrity Show. What do you guys think? Getting to meet Nick. Are you excited about this?
Oh, yeah, I've been pretty excited about this for the last 2 days, yeah.
It's fantastic Macy's is doing this, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's awesome.
It reminds me when I was a kid, and I'm dating myself, when I met Roland Stargell, when I met certain Steelers, when it was Kaufman's, and they would do it, and you get to line up and do the autograph thing.
Yeah.
So, it's tremendous, and when did you hear about this?
That's yesterday. Last time I did one, it was in 2009 after they won the cup. I did it with Max Talbot, so it's the first time since then. This is just so awesome. We get to do it again.
Where are you guys from?
Butler.
Okay, yes, so I'm in Gibsonia, so I'm not too far from you guys at all. So hopefully you get some opportunities. What question would you ask Nick? What do you, if you have
What's it feel like to raise the Stanley Cup? Like that moment when you're putting that thing up the air, I just want to know what it feels like. You know what I mean? It's got to be a cool experience when Stanley Cup.
Oh, yeah. I can't believe I showed up only media. They had two cameras, and I lucked out to get to interview him.
Yeah. You got to interview him.
I got to interview him. I didn't expect that. I expected, like, a line. I'm like, okay,
yeah.
Cool. So, all right. Well, good luck, guys, and enjoy
thank
it
you.
For sure.
Will do.
Young man.
Hi. We're with the Total Celebrity Network and Total Education. What would you like to ask Nick Bonino?
How heavy is the Stanley Cup?
How heavy is it? That's a great question.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you hoping to see it eventually sometime around Pittsburgh?
Yeah.
Did you watch that game or did you stay up that late?
Yeah.
Awesome.
And one thing, where are you guys from?
Mars,
okay. I'm in Gibsonia. So it's for TV, Bethel Park. We're going to put some of this together, but also if there's Verizon channels in certain areas all over Pittsburgh, plus I'm going to put it on as part of after the interview with Nick. Fans' reaction to what they're going to go ahead and do. So it's great Macy's did this, right? I think it's fantastic.
Fantastic.
It really is and exciting. I just got the press release Friday and said, media, to go. I said, I'm coming. There's no doubt about it. And it was such a great opportunity. So good luck meeting him.
Thank you.
Hi, guys. We're media, BPTV, Total Celebrity Show. We wanted to ask you a question about what you think about meeting Nick Bonino. How excited are you guys?
Oh, we're really excited.
Really excited.
Yeah. Looking forward to it. We were the third and fourth people to get tickets. We came right as the store opened, so yeah. Really
oh, really? So you've been waiting since what time?
Well, no, we weren't waiting. We came at like 10 o'clock.
And picked him up?
Yeah. We skipped swim practice, so.
Yeah, okay. There wasn't anyone here. We just kind of walked
just ran
in.
But yeah, it was. We're excited.
That's good.
Yeah.
And once you found out, you're like,
yeah,
blown away. Exactly.
You're there.
Yeah. Yep.
It's great that they do this, and I was talking to people earlier in the line saying I got to meet Willie Stargell when I was a kid, and got to meet certain people like Franco Harris. They used to do it so much more. Macy's should definitely consider that in other places to get in the stars here, because it's such a draw.
Mm-hmm.
And to get to meet somebody after they win the cup, what an awesome experience.
Yeah.
Where are you guys from?
Right over there. McCandless.
McCandless,
yeah,
okay.
Both of us.
Okay, well.
Yep.
Good meeting you guys.
Yeah, thank you.
All right,
thanks.
Take care.
Somebody. This young man. Hi, Total Education Network. What are you going to ask Nick Bonino when you meet him?
Just what it felt like to win the cup. I don't know, just how
pretty
it feels
good. Did you watch all the games?
Yeah, I was at the game too,
you
so it's pretty fun.
You were at the game? Oh, that's awesome. And let's get a close-up there of your shirt. Yes, very nice. Very cool. And where are you from?
Just Score Hill in Pittsburgh.
Okay, well this is going to be on BPTV.
And on the radio, after the radio interview I did with him, I'm putting fans on after the sound bites about whatever meeting Nick Bonino. I'll figure it out. Maybe I'll put it first. That might be good. There you go. Just thinking of these things. I thought I was just going to get a rope off. I didn't expect to get sitting right next to the talk, so that was awesome.
That was awesome.
That was a great experience. Okay, guys.
Let's get this gal. Let's get this cute gal. What are you going to ask Nick Bonino when you get a chance to meet him?
Well, I'm going to say congratulations. I'm going to say, how does it feel to be a Stanley Cup champion?
And I see you're wearing your official shirt. I'm going to get a close-up on that shirt. Did you go out that same night and buy it?
No, next day.
Okay, next day.
Yeah.
You weren't one of those diehards that went to get sporting goods, huh? Were you at the game?
No. No. I wasn't.
And where are you from?
Plum.
Hi, Neil Haley. Nick's Whole Education Network, Tell Celebrity Show, nationally syndicated radio and do TV locally.
Oh, cool.
BPT.
Awesome.
So thanks.
Awesome.
All right. Okay. Are the mics on?
Yep.
Okay.
Mics are hot.
Well, we are live again with Nick Bonino, Stanley Cup champion. That must have been your dream your whole life, to win the cup, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure. Just hearing that being said still kind of gives me the chills. It's a lifelong dream for sure, especially playing hockey growing up is what you want. And to do it here in Pittsburgh made it even better with the fans. And the city won a championship.
How did you feel once you knew you're a champion, Stanley Cup champ?
It's still kind of a pinch me moment. Mm-hmm. I think when Hornquist scored in game six to make it 3-1, we all let out a collective sigh. I think at that point we knew we'd really have to screw up to lose. And we just got the job done. It's been a whirlwind. It's already been a week since we did it. And something that I'll never forget, but I wish I could have that moment back on the ice with the cup, because that's what you dream about and it flies by.
When Crosby handed you the cup, that must have been so unbelievable.
Yeah, I think I actually got it from Hagelin, which was pretty cool, just being on my line. It was pretty cool to see Sid hand it off to Daly, who's played 900 games, and it was his first time winning, and then Duper got it, and we all know he retired, so it was cool to be on the ice for that. It was great to see everyone else hold it, but it was really fun when I got to hold it.
What are your plans when you get to host the cup? What are you planning on doing?
It's going to be pretty low-key. I'm going to go golfing with the cup for sure right away. And then I've said this a few times. I'm going to eat some pasta out of it with my grandparents. She's going to make a big bowl of pasta. We'll put it in there and eat. And then I'll have maybe a local signing at a school and then do a party for all friends and family at night.
What advice would you offer kids that want to be in your position someday, what to do?
Just believe you can do it. I think the biggest advice I have for kids who want to be athletes are make sure you play more than one sport growing up. You see a lot of kids burn out that play one sport year round. I know for me, I played everything. I played lacrosse, soccer, basketball, baseball, tennis. I love tennis.
Right.
You do that, you get a little bit more rounded. You kind of can focus on different things, and it was always good to take a break from hockey in the summers and focus on other stuff and then go back to it, and it was fresh.
You saw that specialization at times keeps you from not being well-rounded, and at times, as you said, constantly playing the same sport, it really burns you out in so many ways. And being well-rounded, you focus on each season, right, and a new opportunity to try something new.
Yeah, absolutely. My freshman year of high school, I wrestled at 103 pounds. I was 99 pounds. So I was tiny. I hit a growth spurt that next year, and that was when I kind of knew I could play hockey seriously. But I was a goalie in lacrosse, then I was a defender in lacrosse. I was a wrestler. I played basketball.
Oh, wow.
I played soccer. So I love to play other sports. I love to golf. Obviously, I love to play hockey.
What's your second favorite sport?
I like every sport. I think right now it's golf. It matches up so well with hockey. I think the only thing with winning the Stanley Cup is that it cuts into the golf season a little bit, so I'll have to catch up on that a little bit over the next month and a half and start working out pretty soon here.
And that's the long season you have. You're right back working out very soon. It's like because hockey season is such a long season, you got to be ready for the next season already almost.
Yeah, absolutely. I think the trainers and team knows that we get a little bit of time to party here and just kind of hang out and rest the bodies, because they definitely need to recover. That's part of it, but we'll get back at it. I'll probably be in the gym maybe after this weekend, golf a little bit this weekend at home, and then start working out again.
Well, thanks for stopping by the Total Celebrity Show. Best of luck to you, and we can follow you at Nick Bonino
on Twitter, correct? Yeah. And tweet you out, and everybody should tweet them out. Okay.
Yeah, sure.
Tweet
thanks.
Out a pic. All right, well, thanks for stopping by. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Excited to welcome the program. This is going to be an interesting conversation. Brian Kenny, MLB Network, from the MLB Network, author of Ahead of the Curve, Inside the Baseball Revolution. Brian, thanks for calling. How are you?
I'm doing well. Good to talk to you.
Great to talk to you, too. Brian, when you think about your years at SportsCenter and things like that, was baseball always like your favorite sport to cover? Through that
No question. That was my passion growing up and going to the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown when I was a kid. Then when I was a sportscaster in upstate New York, I had a talk show. I would do Hall of Fame nights. Yeah, it was always baseball.
Always baseball. Interesting. And so when you had those opportunities come to being part of more and more just baseball oriented, that's just your passion, your love, and learned a lot about it from those experiences, haven't you, in baseball? And
well, that was part of the reason why I would go to, you know, Major League Baseball Network. I enjoyed my years at ESPN. I was there 14 years, but the chance to do baseball full time all the time is something I loved. I mean, even writing this book, like when I would get home at night after working and writing my essays for TV, it was something I enjoyed doing. It wasn't a chore. You know, what's better than studying baseball and writing about baseball? For me, nothing.
Oh, there's definitely nothing, and for sure. And you've just seen the growth. And again, when we talk about this, I think the baseball traditionalists are going to want to debate you on this, right, Brian? And that's another reason why you wrote this book, is because you've seen such an evolution in baseball.
Yeah, and also to take it to another level in, you know, as I learned, because as you write, you learn. And as I wrote the book, I started to dig into more of not just, you know, hey, why do sports writers resist this information? Why do ball players resist? Why did the industry resist sabermetrics? But like, why do we as humans resist? You know, they're human beings like everyone else. And there is a certain faction of people, most of us actually, resist good information. We're hardwired to not do analytical work. I go into a lot of behavioral science in the book as to, you know, how we think and how often do we actually, not only to quote, you know, an interview guru that I interviewed, he works for ESPN, and he has he's boiled interviewing down to a science, and he teaches it at ESPN. His name is John Sawatsky. And I asked him, how often do people accept your practices and how often do they fight them? And he said, well, he goes, some people accept it and the information and they use it, but most people revert back to what they used to do. And his quote to me was, it's easy to change your mind, but it's difficult to change your habits.
And that's the interesting part. Brian, I'm a former teacher, own a tutoring consulting company. So I look at analytics all the time with, you know, testing and standardized testing, looking at specifically what makes it tick so that I have an idea before I work with a student. And then the same thing when it comes to baseball, that when you know the history of these players, when you know a pitcher will bats a certain the batter only bats a certain batting average, you know that if you make this shift, this team will dominate you. Analytics are the key. And to think about all the stuff that's available now, film-wise, via film and analytics, what are they missing? It's just shocking to me.
Well, again, yeah, the new wave of all this is StatCast. You know, now there's, you know, microwave radar rigged into, you know, every stadium. It's you know, it's out there measuring everything that's measurable. You know, tracking players, tracking spin rate, exit velocity, everything that happens on the field. And with that, we now go into another age, you know, the next phase of analytics. And this phase is very, I would call it scouty. You know, this is something that isn't like, you know, that something that will turn off ball players and coaches. This is something these guys love because it's talking about things that they've always valued, except now you'll have these exact and precise measurements.
And how many, so of the teams right now, who do you think does the best when it comes to using these analytics on a daily basis as managers in baseball?
Well, there's a lot of teams at the forefront of it that are kind of in that top tier. I would say the best are the Houston Astros, the Tampa Bay Rays, Chicago Cubs. But everybody has an analytics department. The Kansas City Royals, even though they're kind of they have this veneer of being tradition-based, they've got an analytics department. The Yankees have the largest analytics department. The San Francisco Giants use basically a theory of best practices. They have analytics people. Everybody has it, but the team that is, get to the top of it, the team that's at the forefront of going full bore into this stuff and doing it unapologetically, that it's definitely the Houston Astros.
And then you just saw the change in how they turned around their franchise in such a quick time. Would you owe it to that in a lot of ways, the sabermetrics?
Oh yeah, no question. I mean, they went into it. I do a whole chapter in the book on one of their employees, and this is the gist of it, that they hired him and they put out a press release hiring Sig Madol and announcing him as their director of decision sciences. At the time, it was pretty revolutionary for baseball. Everyone was thinking, director of decision sciences, what is this? Well, here's someone in their employ that is not just making decisions, he's looking at how the organization makes decisions and how they go about making them. Well, that's next level, and I have a whole chapter on Sig Madol and how he examines our own biases and blind spots and how that helps in your decision-making in an organization.
I tell you, it's mind-blowing to think about it, but then you go to the skipper, Brian, and it all goes based on the skipper, right? So basically, the general manager could be all in the metrics and every sabermetrics and all these different things, but then the skipper, the day of that game, and maybe the preparation's using metrics, but when it comes to day-to-day operations, who's the best manager that uses this?
Oh, who is the best manager? Well, it's not even the guys who are, good at using the information or analytics. It's those who make the best decisions given their personnel, given the odds. And those are traditional guys, Buck Showalter, Bruce Bochy, Joe Maddon. You know, being a manager is being – also a leader and a psychologist and a coach and maximizing performance. And there's all sorts of ways of doing that, including Dusty Baker now for the Nationals, who is just, a really good people person. He encourages people. He shows some caring and love. That matters too. Now, when it comes down to, tactics and strategy, I like that part of it because they're making decisions that will cost their teams millions of dollars. But you don't have to be into analytics. Again, Buck Showalter doesn't call himself a sabermetrician, but he's always thinking and always thinking of the best way of doing something and making the proper decisions. That's good enough.
Now, when you talk about all these people, the traditionalists, are you hoping that through your book you'll kind of turn the traditionalists into looking at sabermetrics in more ways?
I would hope so. I mean, I think I wrote this knowing there are – varying degrees of baseball fans. There are those that, a large segment of the population is still looking at pitcher wins and RBIs. And then there's this emerging population, the younger set that is, grown up with analytics and sabermetrics, that has already moved on from ERA and, doesn't consider Triple Crown and all of those things. And they're just looking at StatCast numbers. But I write it, I think, to appeal to both groups, to look into why we think the way we do, and then, okay, what's the next step? Where are we going next? And the founding fathers of sabermetrics, like, these guys are still alive. Most of them they're in their 70s, and these guys are still very relevant, because of their thinking, because of the way they constantly challenge their own thinking and themselves. They haven't become dinosaurs that aren't, with it anymore. They've stayed with it, and I hope I would stay like that as well, always fluid in your thinking and always moving forward.
And that's what you do in your prep work always for baseball, for sure. Brian, best place to first purchase the book? We can purchase it any bookstore for sure. And then information on you, where can we go?
Yeah, I'm at Mr. Brian Kenny on Twitter. You can find the book there. You can also, BarnesandNoble.com, Amazon.com. It's everywhere now. Simon & Schuster has published it. So, you can find it out there. You can Google my name or, look for Ahead of the Curve, and it's out there now, and I hope people enjoy it.
I hope we're going to see analytics a lot more in all different sports. I know that Jim Rutherford of the Penguins really used saber-type metrics to build his hockey club, and I know that they do it in football as well. So I think everybody needs to get on that area, but use the traditional motivation means as well. But take all the information you have and go out there and do it. So thanks, Brian, for calling. It was very, very interesting conversation. Take care.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, see you later. Okay, bye-bye.
All right, take care. No, thank you.
You're welcome. Take care. Bye-bye. You're listening to Total Celebrity Show, and we'll be back in just a moment. Yeah. And welcome to the program, former Real Housewives of New York star celebrity Jill Zarin. Yeah. Let's go specifically enough to what do you, when you decide to be part of a reality television show, how concerned were you? Were you involved in entertainment before that at all?
Absolutely not. No, I was just living my life, and they kind of just called me out of the blue, and they say, Hollywood called, and I answered, and I just, believe in fate and God, and I felt like, if they found me, then this is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Absolutely, and as once you got yourself thrown into this mix, and how producers work and things like that. I was your story, Jill. I've had Aviva on my show before, and I have talked to other housewives from other shows, Real Housewives of D.C., Mary Ammons, different people like that, that you really have to prepare yourself for this because you just never know what the onslaught's going to be, is it?
Well, I have to say I was lucky. Maybe it was fate or foe, but I didn't prepare myself for this because I was the first.
Yeah.
So I didn't have anything to prepare for. And in fact, the show was called Manhattan Mom. So okay. I was shooting a show. I don't know what everyone else thought, but I was shooting a reality show about me and Allie and some other girls and their kids. So that's what we thought. And that's why the first season, you see a lot of me and Allison going up to Martha's Vineyard, doing things together. And of course, when the show got renamed The Real Housewives of New York City, my daughter bailed off the show because that's not what she wanted.
Gotcha, because she knew
which a lot of people don't even know. She just kind of didn't want to be on TV in that kind of a TV show. She knew she's a smart girl. She knew she had a whole life ahead of her and didn't want it to be affected by reality TV. But like I said, I really didn't know. So like when Aviva came on, there was a lot of history already. She was filling our shoes. She already saw the show for 4 years. She knew exactly what she was signing up for. Good, bad, or indifferent.
Interesting. And what your story of the brand being the first of the Real Housewives of New York, really it was not the Real Housewives brand did not, to where it is today, with all these different Real Housewives shows. You up for some more of a reality show? It's about parenting, about family life, and then
Yes. The
gossip hits and the mix hits and. You're thrown into this, and especially in the first season of The Real Housewives of New York, it's saying, holy cow, what did I get myself into, and what are they doing, right?
Right. Well, there was no rule book. So, and I'm sure Aviva probably shares the same feelings that I do because we've spoken about it, is that there's a lot of paranoia that comes into play because, the network did one thing. We had a meeting. After the show was filmed and before we got famous, before it came out on the air, we had one meeting for 2 hours with a media trainer, and that was it. And we never had it again. And we weren't told, what a publicist is, what a publicist does. We weren't told what an agent is, what an agent does, when you need one, when you don't, when you need any of that. Because honestly, and knowing both sides of the street now, because I've done some producing myself, you really don't want the talent to. Because it's like saying, join the union. Why would you tell people you're negotiating with to join a union? So really it was, every man for himself. And some of us did better than others. And some of us were more prepared for the fame than others. Because some of the girls had already been on television or been, in the entertainment business already. So they were more prepared. Some of them took acting classes or whatever, they were just more prepared. And then some were like me and Ramona, we were just like plucked out of our lives. This wasn't supposed to happen.
And you had reasons to do a show, unlike some people that had other reasons. Aviva had
Aviva's reason? What did she say her reason was?
I think to get her platform out there about with foundation work and stuff like that. I think that was the reason for Aviva. A lot of ways to bring awareness.
I don't know. I'm not sure if that backfired on her, though, because I actually just met someone the other day and we were talking about the show. And I love Aviva. She's a friend of mine. So, you know, there's nothing I would say to her, I wouldn't say to her. But, you know, I got backlash about her because they felt that when she threw her leg at that last hurrah, and I know why she did it, so I defended her. But they felt that people who don't know all the story, they only know what they saw, is they felt that, you know, the people who are amputees didn't like that she did that for whatever their reasons are. And I don't even remember why. So I don't want to make it up. I don't remember why, but they didn't like it. And I defended her and I said, well, you know, that was kind of a strategy thing because she was making a point that, you know, no one believed her. She actually was sick. She couldn't take the trip. She didn't get paid because she didn't take the trip. Nobody would not take a trip and not get paid if they couldn't. You know, if she could have gone, she would have. So they didn't believe her. They didn't believe that she was sick and she had to show doctor's notes. And she was trying to make the point like, you know, you don't believe me, you don't believe me. Well, do you believe me that my leg's not here? You know, here's my leg. You know, she was trying to make the point like I'm not a liar. And it's TV. And she was making drama and all that other stuff. So people, you know, I think people were wrong to be angry at her about it. So when she used it as a platform, a little bit it backfired because a lot of amputees didn't like the platform that she used is all I'm saying, you know?
Interesting. And I guess it all boiled down because I interviewed Aviva twice, Jill, and it was before she was done with The Real Housewives of New York. So basically I did not know. She was kind of hinting at me during the interview that this is soon going to be over at one point in time. Then I had her on one more time after that because Mary Amons is good friends with Aviva. And that's how I got Aviva the first time. Then I went through a publicist the second time to chat with Aviva. But I think that truly she had what happens, we get caught up in this world. Once we get in it to the celebrity world, we play into everybody on Twitter. We play into everyone on Instagram. We play into the talk shows. And we forget why we did the show. And Joe, I think you agree with that as well.
Well, it definitely takes over. I think now if you do a reality show like Real Housewives, you definitely know the playbook. There's definitely a playbook. In other words, there's enough books written by housewives out there. NeNe wrote a book. I didn't write about housewives, but other housewives have written about housewives. So I think that if you want to do your homework, there's a lot of things that you could read, interviews you can hear, podcasts like yours that you can hear housewives talk about their experiences. So you're definitely going in a lot more prepared. Like I said, when I went on, there was no playbook. Nobody told us what to do. Even if I were to go back now, which I'm not, I'm saying that, you know, I still wouldn't know what's real and what's not real. I always had a problem with that. I never knew what was real and what wasn't real, meaning what really is happening. And then is it really happening only because of the TV show? And of course it is. So does that make it real or does that not make it real? So like, for example, if you go on a trip with the girls, is what's going on real? Because it is real. What you're saying, what you're doing, how you're feeling is very authentic. But you do know that wouldn't be going on if Rob wouldn't pay for the trip.
Exactly.
So what's real and what isn't real? I still don't know the answer to that.
And that's where you scratch your head and think about things. And look at now, Jill. Things are going even more chaotic. With Periscope, Facebook Live, everyone could be a reality star. And they all could be their own reality
brand. They are. There's so many, you know, people, you all see a bio on someone. I'm like, who's that? And they're like, oh, they're the biggest Instagram star. They have 1 million Instagram followers. I'm like, how'd they get them? You know, naked?
It's amazing.
I don't know. Where'd they come from?
No, I mean, that cracks up. And there's so many different platforms out there for sure. So, Jill, in the experience, I kind of was doing some research on you before the interview. I saw you the Andy Cohen thing back in after they said you were fired from the Real Housewives. You came back again, didn't you, after that?
I was on Andy's show about 8 months ago, maybe.
No, I'm talking 2011. I'm going way back. And the first time
I was on Andy's show then, and then I wasn't on his show for like 2 or 3 years. I hadn't seen Andy. And then I came back in October this year because I was promoting a movie. Well, I felt there was no reason to come back. It wasn't that I wasn't asked. It was that there was no reason to. If I'm not going on to promote something, why am I going on? So I was going on his show to promote the movie that had just come out called Night of the Wild, which I was in acting. You know, I was trying something new that I had never done before called acting. And I don't think I'll do it again. I didn't really love it. It was okay.
No, I'm not Andy. More Bravo. Real Housewives of New York, you were on how many seasons? So, like, that's what I'm trying to get.
Four seasons. Yeah, I was on Housewives for 4 seasons, and I never went back. No cameo.
Okay. Okay, so what year was the end? Was your finishing with the Housewives of New York? I'm just kind of
I don't know. I was on seasons 1 through 4, and right now they're airing season 8.
Okay.
So a long time. It's been a long time, a couple of years.
And I think things have changed so much, Jill, in those years when you first started reality, because I talked about this whole change for sure. So once you realized you were a brand, after the experience on The Real Housewives of New York, you realized yourself you were a brand. You saw it before, but then you really capitalized on that afterwards, meaning to try to build yourself as Jill Zarin. Tell us about that. Yeah.
Well, I did different product lines. First, I wrote a book. I don't know the order. But first of all, Zarin Fabrics, that's our family business. So the reason I did Housewives to begin with, going back to that question, was I did it to have fun, have a great family video, and to promote Zarin Fabrics. Because we have this, you know, huge Lower East Side business, family business since 1936, and we are the largest discounter of drapery and upholstery fabric in New York. And I wanted to expand that, you know, around the world and let people know we ship everywhere and all that stuff. So that was the reason I did it. That was the only reason to do it, was to promote my brand. So then,
you're smart. You were an entrepreneur from the beginning, and that's why you go on platforms. Yeah.
Well, always. So then I came out with different things. I still have Squeeze Couture. I have a shapewear line that's in TJ Maxx and some other stores still. It's been going on like 5 years. And it's a steady, nice business. I was on HSN. I'm not on it anymore, but it's a nice business. And then I did a jewelry line for 3 years, and then that ended. You know, things begin and end. And then I did what else did I do? I did something else. I did jewelry. I can't remember. I do shapewear. I wrote my book. I think I did something else. Oh, I had a home line. I did bedding at Bed Bath Beyond. I tried it. You know, it didn't do well enough to stay. I mean, they have very high expectations. I did not perform to the level they needed, but it was a great experience, and I might do it again one day. But I learned a lot, and I had a lot of fun. And if I'm not having fun, then it doesn't work.
And I think that's the important part. And I like when you said you went on Andy's show just to promote the movie, and we'll get to that. That basically you are a person saying, why am I going to do an interview on a show or go out, put myself out there if I'm not promoting something? So let's go to the book now. Why did you write your book?
I wrote it because I wanted to do it with my mother and my sister. And it's called Secrets of a Jewish Mother. It's all my mother's wisdom, my grandmother's wisdom. From my sister wrote it, physically wrote it. We all gave our stories. And it's a really great book. And it's timeless forever. And not only that, it was translated into 3 languages, Russian, Chinese, and Japanese. I couldn't believe it. They sold it into different languages.
Fantastic.
And I still get residual checks. I mean, I'm not, you know, going to buy a house with it, but, you know, it's fantastic.
Yeah. But it's a brand.
It's exciting. It's a foundation. I do a lot of speeches. I love to do that. I love to travel to like a lot of Jewish. Obviously, I'm Jewish and I appeal to that crowd. So I do a lot of JCCs and Jewish community centers and things like that around the country. I just recently did this one in Philadelphia. And where else? New Jersey. 2 Jewish temples that hired myself and my sister to come and speak about the book. And we answer questions about the show. We talk about the current situation with the girls. You know, we gossip. And in there we throw in a lot of wisdom, my mother's wisdom.
And that's a fun thing. Now let's get to this acting thing. Then you say you're promoting acting. What made you, after the experiences on reality television, want to go to something that's a little bit more controlled?
I got asked.
Okay.
My agent calls me up and says, listen, there's a role I think would be great for you. It's a horror movie. It's with Kelly Rutherford and Rob Morrow, who's like an Emmy-winning actor. He was on Numbers and Northern Exposure, really cute guy. And she said, it's like a lead role. It would be the 4th lead. And I'm like, but I don't know how to act. And she's like, don't worry about it. I'm going to send you the script just to put yourself on video. So my daughter held the video camera. I did the whole thing. I'm a natural actor. I just, you know, I act, you know, being on a reality show is a little bit of acting. You're not acting like lying, But you're yeah. acting. You're being, you know, you don't want to be monotone. You want to have inflection in your voice, and that's all part of acting.
Exactly.
So I did it. I did the audition. I got the role. They didn't even know it was Jill Zarin from The Housewives. They just gave me the role based on my audition tape. And that was it. And I did. I went to New Orleans. I lived there for 2 weeks and with the cast, and I had a trailer, and my name was on it, and I got food service, and I watched how they make movies, and it was really exciting. But I will say it's very slow, and it's a lot of repetition and repeating yourself and all that stuff. And I'm more of a reality star. I like to be one-shot wonder, you know, just say what you're saying and move on. So, you know, I don't know if I have acting left in me, if I'll do another movie. I would love to if I get asked. But I don't see myself, you know, studying Stella Adler and, you know, becoming a real dramatic actor. You know, I can be me. You want a Jewish American princess? I'll get the role. You want someone who's got a big mouth and can scream in a horror movie? You got me too. So, you know, play. And by the way, most actors do play a type. Most actors are not Meryl Streep who can play languages and, you know, an old woman, a young woman. Or this. Very few actors are really that gifted. Most actors play a role. You know, they're a superhero role. They're this role, you know. They're always the mother. They're always the daughter. So, yeah, I liked it. I liked the I did. And I'll probably do it again. But I don't consider myself a, you know, serious actor.
And what you, being in New York, you know the opportunities will come with your agent. Your agent will always want to try to get you some work. So, basically, putting this on your resume is a great opportunity if other opportunities come your way. The right
Absolutely.
Rule comes, you'll audition for it.
Absolutely.
I mean, I think of myself as an entrepreneur, and I'm 6'10", Jill, and I'm a former pro wrestler.
Are you really 6'10"?
Yeah, I'm 6'10", yeah.
And, well, how's the oxygen?
So I'm a
former pro wrestler,
and
there?
Yeah. I was saying I'm a former pro wrestler, and I couldn't imagine filming for 2 weeks when I try to run my business. Businesses.
Well, not just that, it's that's what it's doing. How would you like to say the same sentence 55 times? You know,
yeah.
It's like repeating yourself. Because you say it, they shoot it one way. Then you have to say it a different way. Then you have to say it. Now the other guy messes up his line, so you have to re-say it. Then they take the cameras, they move them around, then you do the same scene again. And then you had your hand in the wrong place because they have somebody watching, so everything has to be in the right place. You know, but actors are funny. They do little tricks. They try to mess up a little bit. Like sometimes they'll move their finger onto a different finger so that, you know, if you really watch the movie, you see that the ring moves from finger to finger because they cut it. You know, they cut the movie, you know, actors.
Interesting.
Tricks.
Yeah. You know, I remember just from one acting experience I had, I did a ice bucket challenge playing Darth Vader, and it was just a commercial for about 2 minutes.
Oh, I remember
minutes,
those
and...
years. That's crazy. Everybody was doing that ice bucket challenge. That's crazy.
Yeah. So that's my only.
Did anybody raise
any
money?
For this one was just to promote Bethel Park Television, one of my TV stations, and so it was a fun thing doing it and bringing awareness. But they raised so much money. I have no idea why they didn't do it a second year. So it's so interesting. That would be a great research to go back. What happened to the ice bucket challenge?
Yeah.
And why
and how much
did
money
only
did they raise?
Oh, I heard tons. So I don't know why they stopped. That was about 2 or 3 summers ago, Jill. I think it was 2 summers ago, maybe 3. When I have 5 kids of my own, Jill, so everything's a blur.
You have 5 children? What, can I,
yes.
Can I be personal and ask you how many baby mamas?
Just one mom.
Oh, that's good. You have one wife.
Yeah, yeah.
One wife.
One wife. One wife. We were married. Our anniversary is July 1st, 16 years we've been married.
Oh, that's beautiful. You're very lucky, man. Very lucky.
Yes. So, but we're talking about, you know, when I say this, that things are a blur. Like last year seems like yesterday, and you know how it is. And you're like talking about, did I talk about this? That was a long time ago, but it doesn't seem. All right. So Jill, basically I was listening to you while you're interviewing. It seems like you're focusing your attention on more after this experience acting, that you want to be involved in reality television, but in a different way now, right?
Oh, no, I don't want to be involved in reality television. I'm done.
Okay.
I'm really done. I'm retired. I love my life. I'm in the Hamptons right now. I'm actually at the hair salon getting my hair done, my nails done, my tan on for the weekend. I had a sleepover last night at my girlfriend's house with, like, some really powerful women. And we did a sleepover. We woke up this morning to breakfast, that the people making breakfast for us. My tennis pro came to the house to give us a tennis lesson. You know, my life is beautiful. I don't want to work. I don't want to do anything right now. You know, and
okay.
some opportunity comes across in front of me, and it looks like it's fun, I'll do it. But work,
so
I don't
just,
like work.
Yeah, so you'll just leave, you'll live your brand and when and keep doing the entrepreneur stuff, but working like reality TV, nah, I've done my thing. I'm promoting my stuff.
I've done it.
My product line, things like that, right, Jill? And the others, and selling
yeah,
my
I'm
book.
Yeah, I'm not saying I would never do it again. In fact, you know what I'd love to say? My friend, I got a caller today to wish her good luck tonight. Patty Stanger's launch of her new reality show on Wii is on tonight, called Million Dollar Matchmaker is on tonight. So I'm very excited for her. And I love watching Patty and hearing all about all the things that she's doing. But I don't think I can see myself back on it again.
And you did
I
have
don't.
A little bit of a reality thing on True TV as well. Do you want to talk about that experience or not?
I did? What did I do? Oh,
you
yeah. That was because I'm friends with Ben Silverman. Ben Silverman has, David Spade did a show on True TV. He called me up. He says, do you want to do this? It was like being punked. It was so much fun. I had the best time, and I would do that in a heartbeat. Those kinds of things I love to do. I did Celebrity Wife Swap. That was great. Amazing. So, you know, if things like that come across my desk, absolutely I'm in. I'm in to have fun. You know,
and
I'm in
you
it to have fun.
You've never lost your fans from the years of The Housewives, have you? That's the other thing I saw on your website. You really still have a great fan base that you stay connected
with. I have an amazing fan base. I still have my fan base. I mean, I hope so. I you know, I tweet and I'm not as good as I should be and I should do it more. I try. I've been Snapchatting a lot lately. People seem to like that. They like my Snapchat.
Oh, I'm still trying to figure that out. Because
the Snapchats are really what I'm doing right now. So people like to see that. What am I doing right now? But I'm traveling all over the world. I just came back from China this spring and then I went to Thailand. And then in the fall, I'm not sure what I'm doing, but I already booked Vietnam, Cambodia, and Laos for February. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I'm traveling the world and enjoying my life with my husband, my family. I did a mother-daughter trip to Thailand, and we lived with the elephants at the Four Seasons
Resort. Are you on the line?
Yes, I am.
So I'm
good
really
morning.
Excited. Good morning. How are you? I'm excited
good.
To welcome the program. The son of one of the original flag raisers of Iwo Jima, Rainey Gagnon Jr., Rainey, thanks for calling, and I appreciate you stopping by today.
Well, thanks. My pleasure.
Now, Rainey, question I'm sure people ask you all the time when they find out that your father was one of the original flag raisers. How does that make you feel, especially coming to like the 4th of July or any of the great nation celebrations?
I sort of address the situation pretty much like my dad always did, in the fact that he was the messenger. He was one that got caught in a photograph that transcends time, that became famous, and he's there. He always said he was there to represent all of the soldiers that fought and gave their life up on that island during that battle.
Yeah. So he's very humble. He was very humble about it when you were growing up with him. Am I correct? It sounds like.
Yeah. Yes, he was. He never wanted to go on display. He felt that his presence would be a reinforcement for all his fellow Marines and sailors, soldiers.
Definitely. And how did your love of our country and stuff develop through your father and for men in service in that process? Did you kind of learn from that process and continue to grow and understand what your father was about once you finally learned about his history?
Yeah, well, it was certainly, I was in a unique position of going through schools and having that photograph come up in various textbooks. And every time I would have to raise my hand and say, well, you all see a great image, American pride, liberty, justice, and I see a picture of my father. And it was very trying to be as humble as I could, but it kept coming up. And it was just sort of, this is who I am. This is my dad. He is not a hero. He is my dad. He was a hero to me above everything else.
You're on. That's fantastic. And you're on the show today because the Smithsonian Channel on Sunday, July 3rd at 9 p.m. Eastern is going to have a special on the unknown flag raiser of Iwo Jima. And this is an interesting part because you can imagine if you didn't know that your father was one of the flag raisers, and anytime a special comes up involving father, it's very interesting for you, isn't it?
Yes, I mean, it is. It's another step forward in the life of Iwo Jima, in the Marines that fought there. And my dad is represented in a photograph that became iconic. And it's a wonderful tribute to everyone that was there. And I find it simply amazing that I could be a part of this to try to keep it alive. In today's day and age, so many things are getting distorted, rearranged, changed. I'm glad to see that the Smithsonian has finally come about and done something to correct the names and to put it down for historical prosperity and the future of our country.
That most definitely. And what is the documentary again going to reveal Navy Corpsman John Doc Bradley? And so that was that interesting to learn about that he's involved in this process in Iwo Jima and how they're going to talk about that.
Well, that's, you know, John Bradley was my father's best man at his wedding. He's been a household name forever. And to see this come about through photographic evidence, facial recognition, there were, you know, misidentified. There was two flag raisings, actually, that day, one with a smaller flag. And Bradley might have confused the two issues. So I'm not sure, but I'm glad to see that Harold Schultz has finally gotten recognition and to go down in history as one of the Marines that raised that flag on Iwo Jima.
Yeah, definitely. And so and Harold Schultz, I mean, and so were you surprised by that in a lot of ways? Or it's great that something else is coming out from this, right? That finally everyone's being recognized for their heart, for what they've done, especially if they were part of that iconic foe.
Right. Well, for several years now, on Facebook and social media and everything else, photographs, stories, everything has been floating around that there could be a misidentification. At first, it was like, no, you can't do that. And then I started thinking and looking at the photographs, and it's like, yeah, they might have made a mistake. I'm glad to see that posterity, the future of this country, will go down with the proper names. Six Marines raised that flag, and that's the recognition they should all have. For the Schultz's family, he never married, never had any kids, but he married late in life and has a stepdaughter. And I reached out, talked to her a little bit, and was glad to hear that her father, her stepfather, finally got some recognition.
Yeah, definitely. That sounds that's great. And so of knowing that she's probably learning more and more about how amazing that picture is and how it really motivates many people in the military today about fighting for our country. That's that photo, I'm sure,
really?
That everyone looks at. Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure it does. I mean, I've got people walking up to me. I've got Iwo Jima on my license plate, and they ask about it, and I let them know. And I joined the Marines, and part of the reason was because of that photograph. And, it inspires people from all walks of life. And when people come up and say, I joined the Marines because of your father, oh, okay, thank you.
And to be involved in a project like this, to talk about this, it's got to make you really, really happy. And I think that this project alone, meaning that's coming on Smithsonian, every history teacher needs to make sure they get a copy of this to play in their classrooms next year, for sure. July 3rd again, 9th.
They definitely do. Yep.
And
I mean, even my grandchildren now are coming across.
That's tremendous, Randy, for sure. It's fantastic. Okay, so everyone could check out the Smithsonian Channel Sunday, July 3rd at 9 p.m. Eastern.